This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech at friendsintech.com.
Welcome to Technorama. I'm your host, Chuck Tomasi, and with me is my partner, Craig Stepp. Normally, we take a lighthearted look at technology, science fiction, and all things geeky, but this time, Craig and I have got another very special interview. We're talking with John Chatterton from the History Channel's TV show, Deep Sea Detectives. John was also featured with his partner, Richie Kohler, in the popular Robert Curzon book, Shadow Divers, in which John and some of his friends discover an unidentified World War II U-boat just a few miles off the shore of New Jersey. The book follows the adventures of John and Richie over the next 6 years as they go to great lengths to identify this mystery wreck. Welcome to Technorama, John. Let me start by saying I am a fan of both the show Deep Sea Detectives on the History Channel and the book Shadow Divers. I couldn't tear myself away from that book, but I'm sure you've heard of that plenty of times. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. It's really my pleasure to be here. Rob did a fantastic job with the book, he's an incredibly talented guy. Richie and I get a tremendous amount of feedback from people that I've read the book, and they're really inspired, motivated, really enjoyed it. So we do a lot of surfing on the wave of Rob's talent. So, but thank you.
One thing I thought that was very interesting was how he, in the book Shadow Divers, he covered your biography from childhood, and you get to see some of the traits as you were growing up that really led you to where you are. Can you give us a little slice of that background?
When Rob and Richie and I all came together, our understanding was the book was largely going to be about the thing that had occupied our interest for 6 years. It was going to be about the submarine. It was going to be about the crew. It was going to be about 1945 and World War II and young men going to sea and all that kind of thing. Several months into it, Rob came to Richie and I. He said, I was wrong. The book that I thought it was isn't the book that it is. And he said, I have to go where the story takes me, you know, which is artist kind of stuff. And we're like, oh, okay, that's nice, Rob. And he says, you two guys, this is really a book about people. And it really kind of revolves around you and Richie. So we're like, okay. And he says, but this means I'm really going to have to research you guys and incorporate you into the book.
He did some digging.
We were still kind of unassuming. We were like, oh, okay. And he says, this means I'm going to have to, first talk to your ex-wives. And we were like, oh, God. And it was, it's an uncomfortable feeling to have a guy who was an absolutely ruthless researcher. Rob spent about 15 months researching the book, and then he wrote it in, like a month and a half or something.
Wow.
It is the way he writes. But at the same time, he's like, oh, well, I talked to, the guy you were in the sixth grade with, and he said this, And so a lot of things, it is an experience undergoing that process where somebody else is really putting your life under a microscope and examining things. And it doesn't matter whether it's, whether the events are around your being a teenage kid or, experiences in Vietnam or, even just as a diver. If you write a book, you get to sit down and say, this is my perspective and this is, it's me on me. And we all kind of think of our lives that way, but with somebody else doing the writing and somebody not just using you as the sole source, you really kind of get a different perspective. You know, Rob would talk to somebody from, you know, I mean, out of my past and say, you know, they remember you this particular way. And you're like, wow, you know, I never would have suspected that. I always thought they would have said, you know, John really, you know, was like this. And so, you know, I mean, it's a growing experience. It's almost like undergoing, like, psychotherapy or something. But at times it was interesting and fun, and at times it was kind of like, you know, scary.
So who were your heroes when you were growing up?
You know, I don't know if I had any heroes outside of my immediate family. I always thought of my grandfather as my hero when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. He was a naval officer, fought in World War II, and you know, retired as an admiral and that kind of thing. And as a kid, I always thought that, you know, my grandpa was, you know, was my hero. As I grew up and I went got involved in diving, I started to read about some of the accounts of early Navy divers, and you had Edward Ellsberg was writing about the salvage projects on the S-4 and the S-51 and all these amazing things, that the developmental years of the Navy salvage diver program. And there was a guy who wrote a book. He was one of Edward Ellsberg's divers, and his name was Tom Eady. And he wrote a book called I Like Diving. And you know, it was, this is a guy, he's a very simple guy. He was kind of like a wild guy, and he found diving. You know, he kind of found himself. And he one of the lines from his book, he writes, anyone can go down, I believe, but not every man can go down and accomplish something. And I just thought that was so profound. It was the way that I felt about diving. In many ways, I guess I was, I felt that I really found myself when I discovered diving, and so he really became my hero. I philosophically, I think he was kind of a no nonsense guy, but he had a true appreciation for the water, for you know, his work ethic and that kind of thing. And,
sure.
You know, I guess, you know, he wrote that book, I guess, in 1930-something, the early 1930s. So I guess I got to start getting some new books or something, don't I?
Yeah. One thing that jumped out at me in the book was, in 1983, you almost went into computers, and you had this epiphany that you said, I can't sit in an office all day. I've got to be out. How did you come to the conclusion that commercial diver was where you wanted to be?
Boy, well, you sure were smart.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I it was more than that. It was a philosophical change that took place, because I was really under the impression that, like, well, I'm kind of, you know, almost a grown-up now, so I should go out and get, like, a job and a real, you know, what makes sense. You know, it's like the scene from the Graduate, where they're going, plastics, you know, plastics, it's plastics, young man.
And you're thinking, computers.
Exactly. And I was like, well, yeah, computers, I guess I should, you know, computers, that makes sense. You know, in other words, if you just look, you know, what should I do? Oh, yeah, a computer seems like a good idea. And the clock was really running out on me, because it was really running out on my GI benefits. So, you know, I felt this you know, pressure to you know, oh, go be someone, you know. And quite literally, you know, in the middle of the night, I just I woke up and I said, I don't want to do, I have no feeling for this. This isn't what I want to do. I don't want to be like a grown up. I don't want to get a job just to be to get a job. And quite literally, and I don't know where it came from. I should be. I'm going to be a commercial diver. And you know, I mean, I've often thought about if there was some kind of subliminal thing going on, but. I'd done recreational scuba diving, but I had no idea what commercial divers did, really. It's not like I'd researched it or anything. And I said right there, I am going to be a commercial diver. And I felt this great, you know, weight off of my shoulders. I was like, oh, man, finally, you know, like this is, and of course, Rob details in the book. I'd awaken my wife, and she was like, you know, what? I'm like, oh, listen, you know, I can't do this, the computer thing isn't happening. She's like, well, you have to do something. You know, how people are when you wake them up at like 3 o'clock in the morning.
That's nice.
Figure it out in the morning.
Hey, wake up. Figure it out in the morning. I think I want to change the course of my entire life. Okay, you know, like, but anyway, she. She said, "We have to do something," and I said, "Well, I'm going to be a commercial diver," and she was like, "Okay, go back to sleep." I still remember my first dive. You know, back then, your first hard hat dive was in a Mark V. You know, with the full breastplate and you know hat and all the heavy water gear and all that kind of stuff, and it was. It was nothing like throwing a super light on your head, you know, in a wetsuit and jumping in the water.
Yeah.
So it was a big deal, and I remember descending to the bottom in this Mark V rig, and the light disappears, and of course we didn't have any lights or anything like that. It was everything was in the dark, and the light disappears, and I was like. I felt like, you know, oh my God, like, you know, I don't think I'm even going to survive this. And I said, but this is what I'm doing. And I got to the bottom and all of a sudden it went from, from fear to this, this wonderful discovery of this new and different world. You know, it was so different from regular scuba diving. You know, my scuba diving had been, you know, down in Boca Raton, Florida, and that kind of thing. This dark, cold, you know, diving in the port of Philadelphia in like, you know, December, I think it was, was so completely different, but it was something that I immediately said, you know, wow, this is for me.
You're probably like, one of the few.
Well, you know, I think in my particular class there were six or eight students, and a year later I was like the only guy working in the industry. So it's not for everybody, and I think sometimes I go and I look at, you know, the guy who's painting the antenna tower or something, you know, the guy who's working on a roof, and I'm like, oh man, you know, that's not for me. You could fall off of that roof and get hurt, you know. So I think we all have different. Likes and dislikes, different perspectives on life, and I have just always had an affinity for diving and especially for you know sites that are kind of remote, dark, cold, that kind of thing. That's a fun day. That's a fun day at the beach for me.
What does it give you, a sense of like you're somewhere else, like other than the earth?
Well, you know, I don't know. I really don't think so. But I think it's it's challenging. It's like, where am I? What is it like here? You know, and you're doing that largely, you know, with just the sense of touch. Everything you're painting pictures with you know your tactile features that you can pick up. And it's challenging, mm-hmm. and it is. You can actually turn that into productivity. You know, the better you understand where you are and what you're doing and how things are. You know, when you're working in commercial diving, you almost work with tools and that kind of thing. All you have to do is misplace a tool, and that's it. You're done. You know, if you can't find it down there. So you learn to you know, like, okay, well, I'm going to put this right here, as opposed to just dropping it. You know,
right.
If you're working with the same tools topside, it's like you don't have to remember where each and every tool is and be able to find it with your eyes closed. So,
right.
You start developing a lot of different skills, perspectives, all that kind of stuff. And luckily for me, all the things that I was doing at work that I really liked about my job really translated well into wreck diving.
This is Adam Savage from Mythbusters, and you're listening to Technorama with Chuck and Craig.
You didn't have any input on the creation or the content of the book until after it was done, correct?
We worked very close with Rob Kirson. Our arrangement was we would make ourselves available to him. We would do everything we could to help him. But
you were not allowed to edit the content, as it were.
Well, you know, there was a lot of trust involved. In other words, it was bigger than we just weren't allowed to edit content. It was a matter of we had to have faith in Rob. So we had to trust that Rob was going to write the, you know, something that was going to be, as he described it, inspirational and motivational. That's what he felt was at the heart of this story. At the same time, you don't want to try and stifle his creativity. But we also realized that you know we were inside the story.
Mm-hmm.
We probably weren't the best people to tell it. So, you know, yeah, it's, you know, I mean, we trusted Rob to do the right thing. There were things that when we read it, we were like, oh, man, well, you know, what about, you know, man, this is kind of creepy. And I would say there were probably a couple of things that Rob pulled out of the book just on the basis of our response to it. But at the same time, there are things that we said, oh, man, that, you know, maybe this shouldn't be in the book. And Rob, rather than just going, you know, like, screw you, it's in the book, Rob would try and say, this is why I think this is important to be here.
How much was accurate, and in your opinion, how much was creative license?
You know, I don't think, obviously, the book is very well written. Rob is a very creative guy. I don't think Rob added anything. In other words, there's nothing in the book that wasn't there or didn't happen or doesn't have some kind of factual backing. But, you know, Rob also started writing, Rob started actually writing the book, writing the chapters, the book was going to be 1,000 pages.
Oh, my.
So, you know, Random House has to come in and say, now, Rob, no one wants to read a 1,000-page book. You know? it's too much information. So a lot of stuff gets pulled out. A lot of stuff gets left on the side of the road. I think in the book, Rob talks about my dives into the e-motor room, And if I'm not mistaken, I think in the book he narrows it down to like two dives.
Mm-hmm.
In reality, it was like six dives, but it's like, you know, it's like I can't put. If I'm putting, oh, and then on this dive, and then on this dive, and then, you know, so in you know, I mean, the book is really Rob's version of what happened, and it certainly doesn't encompass everything. But then again, there's nothing in there that he just, like, made up or he said, I think we got to, you know, I need something in here to fill this out, so... I'm going to take some sort of creative license in here, and I think also, you know, when it comes to, like, you know, Richie, you know, if you're going to write a book, just Richie's in my life, there's a lot of stuff that's not in there, you know. Mm-hmm. Thank God. You know, it is, that's the artistry of this. It's Rob selecting what's going to be in the book and what's not going to be in the book.
He did a good job.
He's a very talented guy. He's writing his next book is about a guy who had an operation to restore his sight after a lifetime of blindness, and I'm sure he's going to do an excellent job. You got to remember when Rob came to Richie and I. We sat down and, you know, I mean, we knew that Rob was a nut. We knew he was, we perceived Rob's relationship with his writing as something that mirrored our relationship to our diving. We were divers. Rob was a writer. Well, Rob's, you know, a couple of weeks into this thing, Rob goes, listen, I have to dive the wreck. And we're like, well, that's a real bad idea. I cannot write this book unless I dive the wreck. I can't. There's no way I can understand it unless I go there. And so we were like, well, what the hell are we going to do? The agent told us specifically not to kill this guy. And so we're like, okay.
A fake boat.
Local dive shop and get certified. And that's step one. So Rob goes to his local dive shop around the corner in Chicago, and he goes in, and the first night of class, Rob already, from talking to Richie and I, knows more than the instructor, so he gets to add these little tidbits of information throughout the lecture, and I'm sure the instructor is like, oh, man, I want to kill this guy. But anyway, he finishes the lecture, and they're all going into the pool. So, you know, they all go in, and the instructor says, okay, you know, everybody jump in, swim a couple of laps, and then we'll get started. So, you know, everybody kind of, like, you know, dives in, and they're swimming. Rob kind of sits down on the edge of the pool, lowers himself into the water, and he's doing some kind of doggy paddle thing that wasn't really even a doggy paddle. And The instructor waves him over to the side of the pool, and Rob makes it to the side of the pool, and he's standing there, and the guy goes, you can't swim. And Rob goes, you're telling me.
Oops.
What are you doing in a scuba diving class? And Rob says, I just have to make one dive, and then I'm hanging up my fins. And the instructor goes, get out of the pool. And he kind of tries to do the Dutch uncle thing with him. You know, he sits him down on the bleachers and goes, what do you mean you have to make one dive? He says, well, I'm an author, and I'm working on a book with these two guys, and they're really good wreck divers, and they're the best. And I just have to make one dive. I have to go 60 miles off the coast of New Jersey and dive on a broken submarine in 230 feet of water. And the instructor kind of looks at him, and he goes, I don't know who these guys are. I don't know, you know, what your intention is, but I have to suggest that you sever all ties with these guys immediately.
Wow.
And he kicks Rob out of the class. So Rob is like, Rob is completely devastated. Rob calls Richie and I up, and he's like, well, I have to withdraw from the project. And we're like, well, what happened? And he's like, well, you know, I've been thrown out of dive class, and I can't, you know. And we're like, oh, geez, you know. So we're like, well, what is it? You know, what seems to be the problem? And he says, if I get water on my face, he says, that's it, I panic.
Wow.
And we're like, well, okay. So what happens when you get water on your face? Well, you know, I get this emotional feeling, blah, blah, blah. And he said, listen, okay, that is panic. Work with that. Because that's at the core of the story.
Mm-hmm.
I said, so work on that emotional stuff and try and figure that out. You don't need to dive to direct. And it took him like a day or so before he kind of like came back to work, so to speak. And he did such a great job in this book because he had to learn every single thing about diving. If he was already a certified diver, there's so much stuff that we learn that we forget that everybody else doesn't know.
Right.
And that's why non-divers have responded to this book as well as divers.
Now, do you keep in contact with any of the guys from the book?
You know, some yes, some not. You know, I saw John Yerga the other day. I talked to him on the phone, and Richie I see all the time. The late Bill Nagel's son, Andrew, at Beneath the Sea. He's in his 20s. He's just getting certified, and I'll be diving with him sometime this summer. There are a lot of people who are, you know, divers in the book that don't dive anymore. I just saw Doug Roberts and Kevin Brennan, I guess, a couple of weeks ago at an event. And a lot of those guys I keep in touch with. To tell you the truth, I saw Steve Belinda at Beneath the Sea, and he came over and shook my hand and said he thought that the book was a great thing. He liked the book, and he also thought it was doing some positive things for diving. And I can't think of anybody in the book that I really am. That's it. I'm never talking to them again.
I'm done.
You mentioned the late Bill Nagel. When you look back at the U-boat experience and think about the lost friends, the personal sacrifice, to you, was it worth it in the end?
Bill's problem was alcoholism, a very complex thing. I have members of my family that suffer from alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very sympathetic to their plight, but at the same time, it's a horrible, horrible problem. At the same time, Bill and I were both the same age, and he's been dead for more than 10 years now. And I just think of all of the fun things that I've been involved with that he hasn't been around to experience. So on one hand, it's like, there's a certain amount of sadness that he didn't do a better job of addressing his disease. And on the other hand, there's part of me that's kind of angry about it. You know, it's like, you know, so much good stuff is going on, you missed out on it. When it comes to the divers, the friends along the way that have lost their lives in diving, I certainly miss them. I think that obviously any death in coming from diving is a real tragedy. People don't strap their gear on and expect for that to be their last day. But at the same time, there is inherent risk to exploration. And at the end of the day, we culturally, as a people, as a species, without that explorer's heart, you know, where would we be? We would still be living in caves, or, you know, I mean, I don't know.
Right.
the identification of the U-boat did not change the world. It's not like the cure for cancer or the new rocket fuel. But at the same time, I don't think we can really, we can walk away from mysteries like that. It's who we are. We have to strive to find out more, and it doesn't matter whether it's at the bottom of the ocean or it's the moon or Mars or on top of, you know, Mount Everest. They're challenges, and we have to address challenges. It's who we are.
Hi, this is Tom Dutchick from Immersion Presents. You're listening to Chuck and Craig on Technorama.
Hey, John, I got to ask you real quick. Have you ever dove the Great Lakes?
Oh, in the Great Lakes? Absolutely. And actually, this summer, we've got a couple of Great Lakes projects. Actually, I should say more than a couple. Richie and I are doing two, you know, preservation fundraisers. And at the same time, we've got a pretty good-sized two-week expedition out there looking at a few different things. I could tell you the specifics of it, but then I'm sure ninjas would drop out of the ceiling and kick my ass for sharing the secrets of the expedition. But yeah, no. And as a matter of fact, we just did two deep sea detectives episodes. That one was in out of Milwaukee.
Okay.
SS Milwaukee Car Ferry.
Oh, you bet.
And we had another one on the Windiat in Huron.
How'd you get hooked up with the History Channel?
When we were actually identifying the U-boat, the last year we were working on the U-boat, we'd been approached by producers from the Nova television series. So, and they did a very successful two-hour program called Hitler's Lost Sub about the U-boat and the identification of the U-boat. That's the program that Rob Kirsten saw that interested him in this story in the first place. Mm-hmm. But we developed a good relationship with the producers who did that show. We became friends. And while Shadow Divers was underway, in other words, Rob was researching the book, the History Channel came to Kirk Wolfinger, Lone Wolf Documentary Group, and they said, listen, we want to do kind of a shipwreck show. We had a shipwreck show, but it wasn't really working out. And what we want to do is put a host in there and make the show kind of like a mystery kind of thing. And Kirk says, well, how about two hosts? And they said, well, yeah, why do you say two hosts? And Kirk says, because I know two guys. I think they'd be great for this. So quite literally, Kirk called us up and said, listen, come on into Manhattan. We got a meeting at the A&E building with some executives from the History Channel. They're looking at a program that they want to do. And so we went in. We had one of those Manhattan meetings. We were on the big conference table. And we left there and we thought, well, you know, they didn't seem that enthusiastic. But, you know, we did get free Starbucks coffee. So for us, it was an okay deal. By the end of the day, they were calling us up and they were saying, you know, we want to do something. We want to do four shows, and I think within about a week or two, it was up to eight shows. And we weren't working with just Kirk at Lone Wolf Pictures. We were working with two different production houses, and of course now, so far, we've done 57 shows. And we're looking at new subjects for this year. It appears they want to continue with the series, but I got to tell you, it is painful to look at some of those early shows we started out with like, you know, cue cards, that kind of thing.
You should listen to our early shows.
We were so not cue card guys, you know. And I think the cue cards only lasted like a day and a half, you know. But it was one of those things where you're like, oh man, this is, you know, this isn't us. This isn't. So in a lot of ways, we kind of grew and changed and evolved and learned. And in some ways, the producers kind of changed and evolved and learned. And of course, now we just aired Titanic's final moments on the History Channel this past February. And for that program, Kirk Wolfinger and Richie and myself were the executive producers of the show. So we took that show, put it together, brought it to the History Channel. That was like a huge step.
I watched that a couple of times. Excellent show. In your words, what was it like to be on the Titanic?
You can't overstate Titanic. We started out months ahead of time putting all this stuff together, putting the trip together, putting the story together, putting the deal together with the History Channel. And, you know, you go and you get on Keldysh, in its own right, a famous ship, you know, and you get out there and you climb into the mere submersible.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's all kinds of stuff going on. There's 125 support people on Keldysh to make those dives happen. So you get into the mirror, and it's hot. You got to pull your Nomex suit down because of all of the heat being generated from the systems to get this thing fully charged and ready to rock. And you hear all the noise from the systems and the noise from the ship and everything. When they close that hatch, it's almost like silent. And then they pick you up off the deck, they splash you in the water, and you watch within a matter of seconds the ambient light in the surrounding water disappears, and you're 2.5 hours down to the bottom. So by the time you see Titanic, you know, this is the culmination of all of this effort, all of the support crew's efforts, and you get down there and you see it, and it is huge. You know, I mean, my job in the mirror was running the camera, so you know you're working the camera and you're working off a monitor to see exactly how you've got the shots framed and all that kind of thing. But then you look out the port. And it is.
There it is.
Amazing. It takes your breath away. You're looking at one of the engines, five stories tall.
Wow.
You're looking at the bow, you know, still, you know, upright. The very prow, you know, just you know. Right there. You look at all of the artifacts, the stern, and you start identifying things, and it is amazing for somebody that has spent most of their adult life diving shipwrecks and interested in shipwrecks and interested in maritime history. It is such an honor to be on the side of Titanic. Bob Blumberg, who is a senior policy advisor for the State Department, came out there with us, and his job is dealing with issues of ocean management and that kind of thing. When he arrived on Titanic, he was totally overwhelmed. He started saying the Kaddish, the Jewish prayer for the dead. For him, it was very much about the people that were there, you know, and he really felt their sense of loss. So, yeah, you know, it is a very, you can look at it from a lot of different perspectives, technologically, how you get there, how vulnerable you are in the submersibles at 12,500 feet and all that kind of thing. But it is truly a spiritual experience being there.
How is the internet or any technology helped you with, you know, shipwreck research? Are a lot of records still stored in traditional libraries and museums, or do you find a lot of it online?
Well, you know what? It's interesting because I was just recently at the National Archives, and yeah, you know, if you want documents, if you want to do original research, you're going to end up in an archive somewhere. But at the same time, you can do a tremendous amount of preliminary research in a very short period of time without leaving, you know, leaving your desk. Quite literally, you can go and get a cup of coffee and sit down at your desk and have a real broad, general understanding of almost any subject that in the world just from logging on to the internet. And what a tremendous advantage that is to anybody that is involved in research, especially historical research. Man, what a tremendous source of information the internet is. You can also use it to find out about where the aliens are living and all that kind of thing.
I was watching a movie the other day, John, and made me think of you. The movie's called Serenity, and in there the captain says, half of writing history is hiding the truth, and it just kind of brought me back to the U-boat experience of how a lot of what you do is uncovering that hidden truth in some of these experiences.
You know, I just last week I gave a presentation at Keene University. Their historical society inducted some new members, and they asked me to speak. And the title of my presentation was History, a Work in Progress. And that is exactly what it is. And when I that was the hardest thing for me to comprehend when I started in with researching the U-boat. I thought history was like all facts. Like, you take all the facts, you put them into a book. Later on, when you want to know the facts, you go to the book, and they're all right there for you. and that's just not the way that it is. It is about uncovering the truth and looking at the documents and trying to determine what happened. And you know what? We all make mistakes. Historians make mistakes. Sometimes there are agendas that are put forth. You know, one of the big secrets of the war in Europe was the Enigma machine. You know, that they didn't. At the end of the war, the Allies did not want the world to think that they had taken unfair advantage by reading the German mail. That would be ungentlemanly. Those facts were never meant for the general public to, you know, be aware of. So, yeah, there are agendas that are followed. There are facts that are hidden and that kind of thing. But it's the historian's job to get in there, get to the bottom of it, and get closer to the truth. And I think for anybody that's out and working in historical documents and working with history and that kind of thing, I don't think you should ever be so presumptuous to think that you finally got to the bottom of it. You know, you can get closer. But you know what? There's always something for the next generation of historians to work on. There's always something that needs to be worked on.
From what I can see, you're a hands-on guy. You usually do the dives in person to the sub. Do you ever deploy remote-operated vehicles or ROVs?
Yeah. We did a show on the U.S. submarine 09 that went down off of Rhode Island right before Pearl Harbor. It was like 1939, something like that. The family members of the crew, the submarine was lost with all hands. Family members of the crew did not want people on the wreck. They felt that this was the grave of their loved ones, and they didn't want it disturbed. You have the same thing with the Edmund Fitzgerald up in the Great Lakes. Mm-hmm. Family members are like, we don't want divers on the site. We don't want a manned presence. And I think that it's important to take into consideration their feelings, especially for wrecks that are still in recent memory, when there are people that can first person say, I remember when this happened. The last thing you want to do, it's not fair to go against their wishes or upset them for, you know, something like a television show. So oftentimes they're willing to accept a remote presence, as it was in the case of the 09. The family really appreciated seeing pictures of the wreck. yeah, you know, I like ROVs, AUVs, submersibles. Everything has a place. And I think there are going to be technological or operational advantages that tell you, oh, I should be using this or I should be using that. I'm willing to use whatever the appropriate technology is, but I got to tell you, more often than not, it's like I want to be there.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton from DLTV and Twit, and you're listening to Chuck and Craig on Technorama.
You are an innovator in a lot of these technologies in diving, or an early adopter, shall we say. Can you explain to the listener what a rebreather is and how it works?
Rebreathers are actually older than conventional scuba. A rebreather is something that recycles your exhaled gas. Usually it goes through a scrubber system that removes the CO2 and then has some type of mechanical system that replaces the oxygen that your body has metabolized from the breathing loop. So essentially it is a continuous loop that goes around and around, replacing the oxygen that your body uses and removing the CO2 that is in your exhaled gas. How it does that, through a variety of means. Some rebreathers are very mechanical. Certainly that was what the first rebreathers were about. They were oxygen rebreathers, and they had a depth limitation of only about 30 feet. So now rebreathers have become far more complex, far more electronic, and not just military and scientific divers have access to them. Recreational divers also have access to rebreathers. They give you a tremendous advantage when it comes to diving deep or for prolonged duration. And they seem to be physiologically much friendlier in that you are diving a constant partial pressure of oxygen. Your diving profile becomes much more of a smooth curve as opposed to a sawtooth step. For divers that are diving rebreathers today, you are making a trade. If you're diving a rebreather instead of scuba, you're making a trade-off between what's relatively reliable open-circuit scuba technology. You know, you just got that piston moving back and forth.
Right.
And rebreathers, like, oh, well, did I replace the batteries in that? And what about my backup battery? And, gee, I hope I don't get water in there. You know, electronics and salt water. Do you think there'll be a problem with that anywhere along the line?
No.
it is, you know, I mean, in many ways, it is an emerging technology. There are definitely advantages to it. And for guys like me, I like playing around with it. I like working it. And there are cases, again, where I see, oh, boy, this gives me a real advantage. For instance, if I were planning a dive to the Britannic, go down 400 feet of water, I want to go inside the wreck.
Right.
Well, 400 feet of water on open circuit, boy, if you get lost, if you were to go inside the wreck and get lost just for a couple of seconds, what's going to happen? Well, your respiratory rate is going to, like, shoot up. You could almost look at the pressure gauge and watch your gas supply plummet. By the way, that's going to make you a little bit more anxious. So now, well, I'm lost. Now I'm really, I've got a problem with my gas supply. It certainly would be a situation that would be difficult for any diver to regain control of.
Mm-hmm.
On a rebreather, you know, you've got the duration of the unit. You know, let's say you have a five-hour duration on your unit. Well, you go inside, and you go inside the rack, and you go, oh, crap, I'm lost. Well, you know what? You can at the same time say, well, not that I won't have decompression issues when I get out of here, but I've got 5 hours to find my way out. And it also, knowing that gives you a psychological support in somehow, some way, completing the dive and getting your dopey butt out of there.
Some of the shows you were wearing a full face mask to communicate vocally underwater. Can you explain a little bit about that and how it works?
Over the last couple of years, I've really gotten into full face masks and comms. The biggest advantage is there are full face masks out there now that really address the issue of bailout. It's always been a problem with full face mask. In other words, you're on the bottom. You're working off of either a second stage regulator or a rebreather. What happens if the thing goes down?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know what? If I'm in cold water and I got to say, oh, yeah, I'm going to rip the full face mask off my head. I got another little mask in my pocky-do over here, and I'm going to take that. I'm going to put that. It's like, oh, man, that's all. I got something bad enough to make me bail off my primary life support system. Now I got to go through this whole full face mask thing. So
right.
There's been a couple of full face masks that have come out that really address bailout. If you have a problem with your primary life support, you don't have to bail out of the mask. So that gives us an incredible advantage. First of all, it means you can have comms. So we've used the Kirby Morgan M48. I've got a Draeger full face mask that has a little bit different philosophy when it comes to it's more like a plug and play kind of thing where different regulators. If you have to go to a bailout regulator, you can unplug your primary and plug in a backup or secondary supply, and all of that I think is working towards making diving more fun, making it better managing the risks involved. I know when, you know, we were out in the English Channel this past summer on a wreck called the Duke of Buccleuch. And I can't remember how deep it was. It was somewhere around 200 feet. Evan Kovacs, the cameraman, developed a problem on his rebreather right as we got to the bottom. We started, like, moving ahead, and we're like, hey, he's not coming along. You could communicate back and forth and say, hey, you know, what's the problem? Oh, I got a problem with my rebreather. Okay, listen, stay where you are. Here, can you sort it out? Okay, we took our support diver, sent him to the surface with Evan. We took the camera, and we still got the dive in. So, you know, it enables you to better manage any kind of unexpected problem you might encounter on the bottom. But at the same time, it also gives us increased productivity because as we're setting up shots and that kind of thing, we are able to communicate from the cameraman to the subject. And, you know, sometimes it's just like the cameraman speaking to the lighting guy. Hey, you're in the shot. Come up 5 feet higher.
Yeah.
It has made a huge impact on us from both productivity and safety issues.
What is the range of something like that?
Well, you know, to tell you the truth, we've got a couple of different systems that we use. We use OTS. They've got the Buddy phone, and they've also got the 2010 transducer that is more of a military kind of model with selectable channels and all that kind of stuff. But I'll tell you what, we've never been out of range. And as a matter of fact, we were diving in the blue hole over this past winter, and the boat was talking to us in like 360 feet of water. And they weren't directly over our heads. So, you get pretty good range on there. The only thing it doesn't do is go through, you know, solid objects like rock or steel or that kind of thing. It's largely line of sight.
GPS and other navigational systems, how do you use those? You know, when you were talking about safety, I kept thinking of GPS so you don't get lost, you know.
I guess the time will come where they will really kind of help divers not get lost. But when you talk about navigating on the bottom of the ocean, I never realized how complex and difficult it was, how difficult it was to translate positioning on the bottom to real-world coordinates until we went out and did Titanic. And it's like almost every Titanic expedition since 1985 when the wreck was discovered by Bob Ballard and his French partners, almost every expedition has had to set up their own coordinate system.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like, you know, we all know that, you know, the bow is at latitude and longitude. So it is some complex technology. We did a show down in the Gulf of Mexico on the U-166, and we actually were there as they set up all of their compats, their transponders, and put everything out so that they could set up coordinates on a site that they had never been to before. And it is a lot of electronics. It is a lot of devices, one talking to the other, and that kind of thing. I believe it took them 18 hours of the six transponders talking one to the other to set up a grid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you know how fast your computer works at home. So, you know, I mean, it is a very complex technological achievement to set up any coordinate system on the bottom. Right now, it's almost impossible to set up true latitude coordinates, it's certainly in deep water.
Well, I have a number of listener-contributed questions. The first one comes from my dad. He said, in Shadow Divers, you did a bit of video, and my dad's also a PADI master instructor. He asked, how has underwater photography changed from then until now?
Video has really come a long way. Even before the U-boat, I was shooting video for industry. You know, I was a commercial diver. Oftentimes, we'd have problems explaining what we were dealing with underwater to the appropriate engineers. So I started early on with shooting video. I like shooting video on wrecks like the Andrea Doria, and I saw a couple of friends of mine that were shooting video, and I thought, wow, this stuff is great. And, of course, back then, great was 8mm.
Mm-hmm.
And it moved on to high 8, and then it moved to mini DV, and then it, you know, now we're at high def, and you've got cameras with true high def format that are extremely small, they're affordable, and I think the biggest change in video over the years is that it continues to become more and more accessible. To the average diver, to the average guy, bring home, you know, go out, dive, and come back on the boat, plug it into the TV set, and everybody's watching what they did on the last dive. It is technology that will continue to improve, but, you know, man, you start making it affordable and technologically advanced, you know, I mean, you're giving people real high def. You start shooting in high def out on your dives and come home and plug it into your high def TV, man, that's something. And it's largely affordable for most divers now.
A friend and coworker who also listens to this show is also a sport diver. He wanted to know your thoughts about Nitrox in sport diving. It seems to be pushed lately as the wonder drug. What are your thoughts on that?
When we used to dive just air, and we used to push the limits on air. You know what? I know we were abusing our bodies. I know we would come up, we would be tired and that kind of thing. If I use purely empirical reasoning, I think Nitrox is good because it makes you feel better. When you get out of the water, you're not so tired. If you look at your typical no decompression dive, you get more you buy more time on the wreck before you have to come up. Certainly, you're buying more deco time anywhere in the recreational limits. First of all, I don't think Nitrox is new. Nitrox has been around for a long time. It's our awareness of Nitrox and our the availability of Nitrox, yeah, that is new. And I'm behind it. I don't think that Nitrox training is requires such a commitment that the average diver would say, well, I don't know, it's too complex for me to understand, or I don't have the time to put into it. My personal feeling is almost every recreational diver has use for Nitrox.
And my mother, who is also a Paddy Master instructor, would like to know what's next for John Chatterton.
How big is your family?
9 kids.
Are they all writing in?
No, I just have 2 parents and a coworker on this one. But my mom would like to know what's next for John Chatterton.
Why wouldn't John Chatterton like to know? People often ask me, like, what's your favorite dive? And I always say, my next one. I have gone from a commercial diver to executive producing television specials. I still am amazed by how much fun I have with the projects that I'm working on. Richie and I just started a new video magazine called Dive Portal. Something new and kind of different. The first issue is coming out sometime in May. It's kind of an experiment. For me, that's exciting. Let's create something, see what happens. Between the success of Shadow Divers and Deep Sea Detectives and Titanic, working with PBS, we have incredible access. And we don't waste that. We fully appreciate it. I can get into places that I couldn't get into before television. So for me, it's like, man, I don't know. I am busy every single day, and I have a hard time saying no to the tremendous opportunities that come my way. I love doing what I do. I realize I am incredibly fortunate to have the ability to work in television, to be associated with guys like Rob Kersen, to be associated with 20th Century Fox. How lucky am I? So to answer your mom, boy, I got the stuff I'm planning to do this summer. We're looking at a return to Titanic. We may be, we're coming up to the Great Lakes for a couple of different projects. We're going to go dive the Andrea Doria for the 50th anniversary. But beyond all that, I'm confident there's something coming. Whatever it is, when it comes by, I'm gonna go for it. On my horizon, there's a lot of cool diving, new projects, an opportunity to work with old friends and to make some new ones. So, believe me, my life is very good right now.
What advice do you have for our listeners?
The best advice that I can give divers is dedicate yourself to the sport. Lots of times divers jump in the water and they swim around and it's important to see the big picture, but the thing is sometimes the big picture is so big you don't really understand it. I think it's important to work at diving, to work at training, at education, at all those the peripheral activities that really make that time in the water more valuable, less dangerous, and more productive. There's a lot of stuff that we can do in the water if we're prepared, if we're motivated. Video is one of those things. And I think that as I travel around, and it doesn't matter whether I'm at a dive show or I'm at a dive boat, I talk to people who are either young people just getting involved in diving or people who have, you've got 9 kids. Some of them are going to end up diving. When I started out, I took a YMCA course. It was like 16 weeks. They wanted you to be a good swimmer. They wanted you to be to really understand all of the intricacies of what could go wrong in the water. You had to study hard. You had to put a lot into it. And I think that, for me, that investment paid off. And I think that it doesn't have to be like a lot of work. It's still fun. It doesn't matter whether you take a course in nitrox or you do some training dives to get ready for the big dive. I think there's a lot more to be gotten out of diving if you make an investment.
It sounds like a lot of good life lessons in there too.
Well, that for me, I'm just a dumbass. I would not know anything about life if it weren't for diving. Quite honestly, the only thing I know about real life are lessons that I learned from diving itself. Work hard. Don't quit. Be determined. If you're going to do something, have confidence that you can do it. You can get it done. That's all stuff from diving. No one was more surprised than I was that I could then take these kind of lessons and apply them in real life, apply them in business, apply them to my job. The things that Rob talks about in Shadow Divers are real things, are real revelations that, you know, I mean, I understand, and I could then translate those things into the rest of my life. I go into a meeting at PBS or the History Channel or something like that. I have done my homework. I am determined to make this project happen, and I'm confident that I'm the guy to do it. And you know what? Other people respond to that. It's not a matter of being arrogant or something like that. You have to put the time in. The difference between BS and really having the goods is diving. You know, BS just doesn't cut it in diving. You get in the water and you don't know what you're doing. You haven't done your homework and you don't have the mental toughness to do the dive. Guess what? You're in trouble. Well, it's the same thing in a business meeting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, John, I thank you for the adventurous story, great TV show, and spending time with us today.
Yes, thank you very much, John.
My pleasure, guys.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to this interview with John Chatterton. You can find out more about John and his show and the book Shadow Divers at johnchatterton.com. I've been your host, Chuck Tomasi, along with my partner, Craig Stepp, for Technorama. Join us twice a week for a bit of lighthearted geek fun on Technorama. You can find us at www.chuckchat.com, where you can download the show or use a program like iTunes to have it automatically delivered to you for free. If you have any comments or questions, please feel free to send them to me at chuck@chuckchat.com. That's all for this time. Thanks for listening.